over and over, then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Israel moving into Gaza with an expanded ground operation, which was preceded by power and communication in Gaza being cut off. ABC's Ines de la Caterra in Jerusalem.
The WHO director general saying the blackout made it impossible for ambulances to reach the injured overnight, though it does appear that some communications may be starting to come back. We actually heard from our ABC producer in Gaza, who we had lost contact with overnight.
There are protests around the world, some for Israel, this one in London, pro-Palestinian.
We need to find a peaceful way forward. Muslims can be a peaceful nation throughout globally. We've been terrorized, we've been victimized, and it's now a time for us to stand.
Retired U.S. Army General Robert Adams says destroying Hamas will come with a cost.
An unintended consequence on the people, of the innocent people and the non-combatants. And this is the biggest challenge, I think, that Israel faces.
With continuing coverage, Israel-Hamas war. This is ABC News. Today is the DEA's Drug Takeback Day. That's a nationwide way to dispose of old, unused, or unwanted prescription drugs. ABC's Andy Field tells us why the DEA says giving them back is better than just throwing them out.
Accidental drug overdoses killed more than 97,000 Americans in 2021. It is a big reason why DEA is holding its semi-annual Drug Takeback Day this weekend.
A majority of people who reported misusing a prescription medication, they literally got it out of a medicine cabinet.
DEA Deputy Assistant Administrator Matt Strait says tossing those dangerous unused drugs at a takeback site guarantees your child or teen won't find it. Andy Field, ABC News.
And you can find a location near you at takeback.com. At a renaming ceremony Friday in Augusta, Georgia, Fort Gordon became the last of 9 U.S. Army posts to be renamed, part of the Department of Defense initiative to redesignate Army bases named after Confederate soldiers. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
UPUS Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. It's the time of year when temperatures start cooling down, but experts say climate change is making October nights in Wisconsin warmer more often than not. Here's Mike Mohn.
A new analysis from the nonprofit Climate Central says fall evening temperatures in the U.S. have warmed by nearly 2 degrees on average since 1970. And it's even higher in cities like Madison and Milwaukee, which has seen increases of nearly 4 degrees when looking at minimum temps. Climate Central meteorologist Lauren Casey says it doesn't just affect traditional fall activities.
Allergy season has been lengthened by about a month in many locations across the Midwest.
She says that makes it more burdensome for people with more serious respiratory issues like asthma. And the analysis points out that mosquito season is being extended too. Casey says to help mitigate these trends, Midwest residents should do what they can to avoid energy sources that come from fossil fuels. And Casey says adapting to these changes is another important step so that folks aren't caught off guard when the calendar flips to October.
So you can best prepare if you do have asthma, you know, if you are potentially susceptible to mosquito-borne illnesses, all of these things which can impact our everyday lives.
For prolonged allergy seasons, health experts say vulnerable individuals should put some time and research into establishing a medication regimen that works for them. Meanwhile, Casey says the warmer weather results in heavier rain events, which attract more mosquitoes. She suggests that you be more mindful of areas of standing water as the fall drags on. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Every livestock farmer knows they can't control the weather. Recent growing seasons have shown rain can be hard to come by at times. Now you can add protection with a pasture rangeland forage policy through Ag Country Farm Credit Services. PRF policies help protect you against future yield losses caused by a lack of rain. Better yet, they're customizable and can cover hay and pasture acres. To learn about a PRF policy, contact your local Ag Country office today.
Gah, I'm so stressed. Our business is growing. We've got people all over now.
Ooma.
What is that? Meditation?
I'm recommending the Ooma cloud phone system with auto attendant and more than 50 features.
Ooma?
Yep. Switching to Ooma is a cinch. Just $24.95 per month per user, plus taxes and fees.
Ooma.
Now you're feeling it. Find small...
This is a special broadcast of the 7th Annual Cap Times Idea Fest, which returned to Madison on September 17, 2023, with leaders from government, business, education, social justice, and culture. Coming out of the tumultuous times of last year, the Idea Fest moderators and guests looked ahead to what the future could look like in Wisconsin. The theme focused on how we reckon with change brought on by the pandemic, the Black Lives Matter movement, and other forces. The event was a hybrid of online and in-person events, and Civic Media has proudly partnered with IdeaFest and now presents segments of this year's gathering edited gently for time. Moderator Molly Lasagna, Ascendium's Senior Program Officer for Education Grantmaking, continues with community leaders about community support and reforms for higher education in prisons.
Dr. Moreno.
So my name is Peter Moreno. I direct a couple of prison-based education programs at University of Wisconsin-Madison. The first is Odyssey Beyond Bars, a college jumpstart program, and we've just established a new unit at the university called the Prison Education Initiative, which is building on the success that Odyssey Beyond Bars has had and beginning to offer certificate and degree programs in the prisons, which we're really proud of. Great accomplishment for the university. I started doing this work in 2018. Prior to that, I worked as a clinical law professor in our law school here at UW-Madison, and then also at the University of Washington Law School. There's some debate as to which is the real UW between those two. Yeah, right.
Yeah, not in this room, there's not.
Yeah, exactly. So
Shannon.
So I bounced between those worlds for some time. And what I learned doing that work was a lot of lessons that I don't think that I could have learned if I hadn't spent some time in the prison system talking to folks about how they wound up there, going to neighborhoods where violent crimes had been committed, talking to witnesses and family members about that world. And what I saw doing that work are a lot of the issues that we all see from a distance on a day-to-day basis, the problems we all know are there. We have deficiencies in our school systems. We have deficiencies in our social services. We have deficiencies in mental health. And in certain neighborhoods, these deficiencies are really extreme. And when folks grow up in that environment, a lot of the times there is a culture of inevitability that you will someday wind up in the criminal justice system. And for the folks who wind up there, I got to see this pretty up close. The deficiencies definitely carry over into the criminal justice system. And what I want to say before I go any further is I don't think that this is a problem of lacking dedicated people in these offices. We all know dedicated teachers. The State Public Defender's office here is filled with dedicated people, led by the most dedicated of them all, Kelly Thompson, who's one of the most inspiring lawyers I know. We all know that the capacity is there. The reason that we have deficiencies in the systems are because we collectively as a society have determined that we are prepared to engage in a certain level of investment in those systems. And once we hit that cap, we step back from it and say, no, that's enough. We know it's deficient. We see it. We chronically underfund it, and we know that there's deficiencies in this system. We hope for a better outcome every year, and it never comes. And we think, Oh, darn. You know, well, what else can we fix? Well, I'm here today because I have at least one answer, and that is spreading higher education in our prison system and changing the culture of what we expect our prisons to do and what people expect out of the prison system when they are incarcerated. That has to change, right? I further think, because of the experience, my personal professional experience in the criminal justice system, and seeing so many people enter it and have to experience these deficiencies when their liberty is at stake, which in this country to me is the most important thing we can take away from a person, we don't pay enough attention to that. So when I see a person suffer through these deficiencies chronically, from the time they're children through the time that they're incarcerated, it makes me want to do something different and to change the level of investment that we put into people who do wind up into the system. And so that's what I'm all about, is not only expanding the options that we have available for people in prison, but raising the bar of what education means in the prison system and how we deliver it. Because I want to deliver the best quality college and prison program I possibly can, because I think people deserve it in prison. And what we're seeing, we're early in this process. I'll wrap it up soon.
You're doing great.
We're early in this process.
Sermonize, man.
We're early in this process, but we're seeing the returns on that already. And I want to read to you very quickly a quote that we have from one of our students who took English 100 through Odyssey Beyond Bars. His name is Randy. Like many of the great men I have read about who had faced adversity and overcame their situations, I too can redefine my reality by recreating my life as I see myself today. To me, that says it all. What we're doing in prisons is empowerment. It's empowering students to see themselves in a different light, their future in a different perspective, see themselves as more than an inmate, more than a number, see themselves as having potential and on a trajectory. And so that's why I'm excited about this conversation today. So honored to be on this panel with great panelists. And I thank you all for coming here tonight as well.
Good luck, Jonathan.
I got something. I'm Jonathan Stinger. I'm the Chief Strategy Officer at Youth Build USA. And Youth Build USA is a global support center for programs around the world that work with young people who are disconnected from employment and education. And I arrived at Youth Build USA because of work that I did inside jails and prisons. And I arrived at that work inside jails and prisons because I'm formerly incarcerated. The work we did when I was working in jails and prisons in New York, we worked in Rikers Island and in 30 New York State prisons, was really about the point that Peter was making about creating spaces for people to see their full access to humanity in a way that the prison system really was designed to remove. And one of the things about higher education in prison is that inside, you know, we were talking earlier, the panelists were talking earlier about the way students show up to class in an incarcerative setting and the way that they take on the reading and the work, because there is something there that has been so totally removed from them in a prison setting. And that to me, I mean, there's so much potential there for individuals. And we're going to talk about, I think, the economic benefits and all sorts of wonderful things that happen with recidivism and all that stuff. It's great stuff. But it's not the point for me. The point for me is that there is an opportunity inside these settings for people to be whole people, to have relationships with their families again, that we have set up these walls to keep those people out. And if we can send in dedicated faculty members that are willing to be there with them and talk to them like whole human beings, there's something that's possible there that I think otherwise just absolutely is not. So Youth Build USA. I moved from working inside jails and prisons into an organization that works with young people who, many of whom are court involved, right? They've had some interaction with the court system. And here in Madison, by the way, the local Youth Build program is Operation Fresh Start. You guys probably know it. It's an amazing program. The idea, that same idea that what is possible inside a Youth Build program is an opportunity for a young person to see a future for themselves that they never thought was imaginable. And in fact, the idea that a young person probably is seeing themselves winding up in jail or prison, that feels like an inevitable outcome until you walk into a Youth Build program and you are surrounded by the love and attention that exists in that space. I think the same thing is possible in a higher ed classroom in prison. I just want that to happen before young people wind up in jail and prison. And certainly, if and when people are incarcerated, yes, we need high-quality education programs for folks to have that experience. But, you know, I think we know there are things we can do earlier in the system so that this is not the intervention that feels essential and inevitable.
Did I know you were formerly incarcerated?
I don't know, man.
Like, I've known you my whole life, and I just learned that for some reason. So my name is Shannon Ross. I am the executive director of, first, let me thank also Cap Times and Molly and whoever put my name in the hat to be here. I just got an email one day, and so thank you. So my name is Shannon Ross, and I'm the executive director of an organization called The Community. I say it like that, otherwise people think I'm the self-appointed executive director of the overall community, but it's an actual organization. And what we do is we're trying to focus on basically expanding the understanding of higher education and also the way it's accessed. Right now, there's a lot of limitations on the way you can access higher ed and programming because of a variety of ways that correctional systems operate, and add on to that COVID and low staffing, and it makes it even more difficult. So having ways to increase that access so everyone always has some access to something to continue to grow and develop is a big part of what we're trying to do with our newsletter that goes into a large percentage of the prison population in Wisconsin, and a learning platform that we're developing, and a lot of self-empowerment work that we do called Correcting the Narrative. I'm also the co-founder of a for-profit called Paradigm Shift, because if you're formerly incarcerated, you definitely have a consulting agency or you write a book. And so what we do basically is we have done a lot now in this youth space, and we're building out a collaborative youth hub in Milwaukee, about an 80,000 square foot building that we found our way into that has its opening if you're in Milwaukee on Monday. In addition to that, I'm a fellow turned consultant at Marquette University's EPP program, which is Education Preparedness Program. I'm a fellow in DC with Education Trust. And before all of that, I've spent 17 years in prison, and I've been out for 3 years now for a violent crime. And I say that because it's important, because I think a lot of times in our space, the view is on nonviolent crimes, drug offenders, whatever terms that you want to have as the low-hanging fruit or the place that gets the most attention. But the reality is that the majority of people in prison are in for violent crimes. And until we address and face the reality that human beings commit very terrible and violent things, but they're still human beings, and many of them can come back and produce incredible outcomes in society, oftentimes they're the people that are in the best position to do that. Until we can grapple with that and face that, we're going to continue to have this problem no matter what we do. And so it's just, for me, really apropos that I'm here also, because when I was incarcerated, not too far from here, in about 2017, Cap Times published an article that I wrote called Unpalatable Truths in Criminal Justice Reform. And so, yeah, it's kind of a full circle moment, and I'm happy to offer whatever value I can to this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you. Y'all see what I mean about this panel? Ugh. So I've got two kind of big questions that I'd love to pose to the panel. And they're sort of the two questions that ground this conversation overall. So Paul teed them up at the beginning. Let's go back to the way we started this conversation, which was about this sort of ecosystem of support. One of the things I was thinking as I was listening to Peter and Jonathan talk, I was thinking about how when I ran a higher ed and prison program in Tennessee, and we would ask students in the program, what's your favorite thing about being in this program? Always they would say, because when I'm in this classroom, someone is talking to me like I'm a person. You cannot overstate the value that you're bringing with those interactions. And also, I think the thing about doing this kind of work in prison is that you are creating community inside of a system that is intentionally structured to divide people from each other. And so that work feels very powerful if you're inside of that community. It can feel dangerous if you're outside of that community, right? It can feel disruptive sometimes in these carceral settings. And yet I would argue that, again, that work of, I don't like to say rehumanization, because no one is not a human being when they're inside a prison. Everyone is still a human person. And yet, there is a process of dignity reclamation that can happen in these prison programs, higher education programs, reentry programs, transitional programs. And so I wanted to spend a couple of minutes asking the panel, so when we talk about what is in this ecosystem of support, I often refer to it as a constellation, a patchwork quilt, but I want to think a little bit about what it looks like to create that ecosystem of resources so that we are providing authentic support in moving folks from incarceration to graduation and beyond. And I want to note here that I think it's important for us to say graduation and beyond, because one of the things you will hear is that the credential is not enough. The degree is not enough. It's not going to catapult me over the collateral consequences of incarceration, right? So I need that degree, but I need that degree to bring with it access to opportunity. I need it to bring a network of folks from the free world who are going to help me when I get out, right? Who are going to open doors for me so that I can put that degree to use. So when we think about this, again, this movement from incarceration to graduation and beyond, who are the players in that ecosystem? Where are the partnerships? And where does that work start in a community?
This is a special broadcast of the 7th Annual Cap Times Idea Fest, which returns September 17th, 2023 to Madison with leaders from government, business, education, social justice, and culture.
Part of the work of the Urban League is to be a part of that ecosystem. And as people are coming and reestablishing themselves in the community, is to make sure that they know where the resources are. To make sure that when they are trying to get a job, that some of those things that may be on their record, that we can help them expunge. So we run an expungement clinic in a partnership with five other entities. Most recently, we worked with a person who actually had a felony. They actually came through our training program. They did some work with Ascendium and other folks, the Wisconsin Legal Action, and they were able to put their lives back together. They were able to come through one of our workforce training programs, and now they're working at Grace. We've also had individuals who have come to our programs and not knowing where to go. But we have done expungement, and we have worked out situations where they might need an adjustment, you know, in their child support. One of my staff is here, Eugene Chrysler, who runs our fatherhood program, and he runs our adjustment clinic and really helping young men and young women find their way back. And we can't give up, you know, on these people when they come back to society. We really have to help remove barriers. But they face discrimination when they go for housing. And so we have to make sure that we're helping clean up their records so that they, when they go in to get an apartment or when they go in to get a house, they can find it. You know, they deserve it. They put effort in to get, you know, a high school diploma or a college degree. And so they deserve the help. And we are the type of organization that we can use our reputation to bring individuals together. The Wisconsin African American Law Association, we bring them in and other partners, Foley and Lartner and other folks, to bring resources that they don't typically have. And so we have to continue to find ways to help these individuals find their way back to access to opportunities in the community.
I think the issues, the questions that we are asking about what to do when folks come home are really important questions. They're absolutely things we've got to ask. And I also think that the work, reentry work, really belongs at the very beginning of this process. It belongs
louder
in the sentencing process. Frankly, it belongs before the sentencing process, but and it needs to involve the agencies that are involved in sentencing and prosecution and detention. And there needs to be space within those administrative agencies. And I know this can be especially challenging here in Wisconsin. It certainly was challenging in New York, and it took decades and decades to build an ecosystem of programs that begin working with people at the time of arrest and planning for that person's release. And of course, it's not always perfect. It's a messy system. But to know that everybody's coming home, right? Just take that as a given. Almost everybody's coming home. So if you know that people are returning to the community, and they're going to be your neighbors, right? This is just the reality of the number of people we incarcerate in this country. What do you want from the people who are coming home? You want them to have good relationships with members of their family. You want them to have an opportunity to have a safe place to live, to feel safe, to feel like they're a member of a community and can contribute. And if you can start that at the beginning of the process, then they've got a good shot at it. If you start it 2 weeks before somebody's coming home and they're terrified and they've been in prison for a decade, you are creating a system that is probably not going to succeed the first time somebody comes out, despite the fact that all they want is to stay home when they get out. Nobody wants to go back.
Yeah, I would echo a lot of what Jonathan said. So the work that we do in prison, we call pre-entry. Another term that I use for it is guerrilla reentry. And the reason I do that is because we rely on the system way too much. We go to the system to try and say we're going to force the system to do its job. Well, it is doing its job. It's not doing what you think it's supposed to do, because that's actually what it's supposed to do, this warehouse. So it's on organizations that are in this space to kind of, you know, observe what's going on and address the actual situation of the place you think should be helping them isn't going to. So let's do that ourselves. Let's work together. We can do a lot of things on our own without the system having to get involved. In fact, I prefer to do things that don't involve the system, because it makes it very easy on me to not have to deal with massive obstacles and barriers and 2 years to get something approved that then maybe gets shut down because of a staffing issue in a month. And so what we're doing in that space is, even up here with collaboration, you talk about partnerships. Very recently, I think even this week, reached out to Jonathan for something we needed at our collaborative hub in Milwaukee. He connected me to somebody. We got, you know, an electrician to help us work on some stuff. Peter, one of his team members, Pearly, is on a project that we're working on, right? So these are people that, you know, we lean in and we lean on each other commonly in this work, as we have to kind of get feedback and ideas, and to be held accountable is another very, very important part about it. I think we run from feedback, we run from criticism, and we also have the tendency of doing the exact same things the system does, but we treat it as if it's like, you know, altruistic, or it has a purpose when it's coming from a nonprofit or from somebody who was formerly incarcerated sometimes, right? We have to model the exact behavior that we want from the system, and that's not easy to do. And there's a reason the system doesn't do it, because it's not easy to do. So it's on us to really challenge ourselves, and at the space that we're building out, we're really trying to do that is be intentional from the very beginning of how do we lean in and say, every time that I want to run away from this, or every time I want to question or cuss somebody out, I'm going to actually like embrace the principles of restorative justice and talk to the folks that I had a problem with, or have systems where we're always doing the difficult work, because we can't expect or ask other people and systems to do anything different if we ourselves are not able to do that exact same thing. And so that work that Jonathan talked about is just so important, where reentry is massively important. But I would argue, I might be biased in this sense, but having spent a lot of time in prison, I would say significantly, you know, indubitably, that the work that happens before a person is released, way before they are released, is what matters most. Because you are just dealing with luck of the draw and hoping there was some semblance of foundation and stability still there when a person comes home. We can keep that and strengthen it when they're inside. Not even with the system. Again, there are ways to do it that we can just utilize avenues the system has made available to organizations to get that stability and get that health. We're creating a fellowship program for people in prison right now, right? So we can create leaders who then create more leaders inside. And we're doing that without the DOC at all. We don't need their assistance. We don't need their approval. We can do that through modalities they've given us access to as the public. And so how do we just kind of be creative and lean on each other more in this space, I think, to address that pre-entry work, so that when people come home, the next stage has even a better chance of helping them.
The only thing that I would add to that, so the discussion of reentry is really critically important. And I just want to relay a story briefly. When I first started doing this work, and I talked to Anthony Cooper at Nehemiah, and we had a couple different ideas for classes we were kicking around. And I said, you know, Coop, I'd love to just get 10 minutes of your time and talk about this. We finally got a chance to meet. And I said, oh, we're thinking about these two classes, and this would do this class, and this other class would do this. And he just looked at me and he said, well, okay, but what are you going to do to prepare people for reentry? And I said, well, I'm not, we're a college program. We're not thinking about reentry.
I'm so glad you're telling this story.
We're doing, you know, we're working through like curriculum right now. And he's looking at me and saying, okay, but how is that going to lead to success upon reentry? Like, why are you connecting that to reentry efforts? I felt like we were really talking past each other, and we weren't. He just saw the light long before I did and was telling me, you have to be thinking about, as you're framing these programs, how is that going to be part of reentry planning generally? How is that going to integrate with reentry support? So I want to say that. The only other part that I would add is that I think colleges that are operating in the prison system are a part of this ecosystem, obviously, of moving people towards degrees. And I think we start, what we're doing now at UW-Madison is we start by looking at what we offer to undergrads on campus. And it's a lot. I mean, most undergrads aren't aware of it, but there's pre-admission counseling, there's academic advising, there's mental health support, there's all these, you know, special needs support. There's all kinds of supports that we offer to undergrads on campus. If we start there and use that as the basis of what we're going to be offering to students in prison, including career planning and alumni support, to me, that would be a good start for colleges to be thinking about their role in that way.
Yeah, you teed perfectly up what I was going to say. So thank you for saying that. What I was going to just note quickly, I think, before we transition to a question that is, at least on the surface, a little bit more specifically focused on higher education, is that, number one, I think as you listen to these panelists, it should become clear to you that the process of getting out of prison is not easy, right? So reentry is incredibly challenging. That first year in particular out of prison is a really, really delicate time. And so for those of us who work in the higher ed space or adjacent to the higher ed space, it is incumbent upon us to think about what are the wraparound supports that we provide for this population of students in that first year, out on the way out of prison and in that first year, so that continuing college is even close to being a reality for folks, right? I mean, I used to say that our students in Tennessee in our program, 100% of them intended to continue college in the free world when they got out because they were having really positive experiences in the college program on the inside. But the reality is, again, getting out of prison is really hard. And so it is for those of us who are in the free world who are doing these kinds of supports, those of us who are members of this community, for us to be able to think about together, collaborate on how we create that ecosystem of support so that this population of students can continue to succeed academically and beyond is a really important piece, I think, of this puzzle.
This is a recorded session of the annual Cap Times Idea Fest, held the week beginning September 17th, 2023 in Madison. More to come after these messages.
Connecting with you on air, online, and on the Civic Media app. This is Lake Air 1260 AM, WLAK, Amory's radio station.
You're listening to a special broadcast of portions of the annual Cap Times Idea Fest, which returns September 17th, 2023 to Madison. Moderator Molly Lasagna, Ascendium's Senior Program Officer for Education Grant Making, continues with community leaders about community support and reforms for higher education in prisons.
As you heard, I think, earlier in this panel, the ban on Pell Grants for incarcerated students was lifted as of July 1st of this year. That's not when advocacy for it started. Jonathan would tell you that it started before the ban even went into effect in 1994, and he would be right about that. But from 1994 to this year, there was no federal aid available for this population of students. The Pell Grants were prohibited for incarcerated learners, other than in the Second Chance Pell experiment, which you heard a little bit about from Dr. Alfred. But other than that small scale experiment, no federal aid for students. Well, that has now changed. And so there has been a lot of enthusiasm around the potential for expansion for programs because aid is available now, right? Because we're talking about public federal dollars being available now to support this population of students. I think if you think about it for the next 30 seconds, though, then you get to this point where you think, whew, okay, so the dollars are back. What is that going to look like? How are schools going to prepare not just to draw down Pell dollars for these students, but to provide the kinds of programs and supports that will then ultimately help these students capitalize on those Pell dollars, right? If students who are incarcerated are spending their Pell dollars, which there is a finite amount of, spending their Pell dollars on these programs while they're incarcerated, we have a responsibility to do right by those students and be sure that we are creating programs that actually help them get value out of those Pell dollars, right? So my question for you all on the panel is, so if the goal, let's say that one of the goals of higher education in prison is, as we talked about earlier, upward mobility for students and for currently and formerly incarcerated students. How should colleges be thinking about ways to most effectively leverage those Pell dollars in the interest of student autonomy, self-determination, future success? What is that sort of, you talked to Dr. Alfred earlier about sort of a mission or a mandate for the school. Tell us a little bit more about what that looks like.
Yeah, I think it's really important to understand, one, is we're all here because we recognize and I think realize that there's an issue. There's an issue just overall with us being able to support the culture, the mindset of the incarcerated student and their ability to be looked at as a individual or human within society. I think when we're thinking about as far as the Pell dollars, I want to make sure that it's very clear that although the Pell ban has lifted, everybody can't participate in this space. The Department of Education has created several milestones that institutions who want to operate as a prison education program has to jump through in order to, in a sense, look at that light at the end of the tunnel for our students. So just thinking about that, just overall, the partnership has to be there. It's written into law, basically, that indicates that institutions that want to be a prison education program have to establish those community partnerships. You have to be accredited. You have to make sure that your programs are equal to what you provide to students that are on your campuses. You have to operate in the best interest of students as participating in these programs. And that's putting, as far as that good foot forward, one is to ensure that there's equity in the programming that's taking place at our institutions of post-secondary higher education. And then also ensuring that there is quality education to help prepare our students so that when they transition out, they are able to get a quality, sustainable job that's going to help carry them forward. I think is really, really important as far as even as we're thinking about partnerships overall, that we're able to, as an institution and community individuals and members, are able to connect with employers that are going to be willing to hire our students as they transition out into reality and society. Because if they don't have that upper hand, then they're going to be basically put into a situation where they have to make a decision as far as how do I survive. And I've had numerous conversations with students, different folks. I have family members that's been incarcerated where it's basically different things has been put before them. Like, you know what? I am looking at a brick wall and I don't know what decision I need to make. So that's where that partnership, those conversations like we're having now to really illuminate what some of these issues are and some of those challenges are in order to create that opportunity for that access to education, but then also that access to employment, but then also that access to support outside of that. There are a lot of things that transpire when I'm noticing when it comes to incarcerated students that even as they're transitioning out, there are resources and finances that they need in order to make their transition smooth. So being able to connect to community organizations, to donors, to partners, in the sense that say, hey, I'm behind you and I want you to be successful, I think is what's going to help us push this forward and really materialize the impact of those Pell dollars. One other thing that I want to mention, when it comes into Pell dollars for institutions of higher education, right now the law is written that only certain elements or components of that Pell grant can go to certain things. For example, tuition, books, supplies. There's no, in the sense you would think of the traditional sense of a student attending college and you might say, oh, I got a refund check or excess cash check. That doesn't occur for the student that's involved in prison education programming. When it comes to that Pell grant, they only receive enough, in a sense, to cover whatever those educational costs are. So it doesn't give, in a sense, that platform or those dollars, in a sense, for a student to be successful. They still have to rely on their friends or other folks, in a sense, to be able to help support them while they're going through their program. So I just want to make sure I shared that information and that insight.
So when you say that Pell dollars for this population of students can only cover really what we consider cost of attendance, does the school make the determination of how much it costs for an incarcerated student to attend that school? And then sub question, can that cost of attendance be different than it is for the students on the Free World campus?
Yes. For your first question, can an institution, in a sense, dictate as far as what that cost of attendance? In some cases, yes. There are some standard, depending on what system you're in, UW system, WTCS, Wisconsin College Technical System, has as far as set tuition amounts, but there are certain elements of the cost of attendance where we can dictate as far as what those costs are and build them in into that student's cost of attendance in order to be able to support them. And your second question?
What was my second question?
Oh, will they be different?
Right. Thank you. And, can it be different than the free world?
Actually, so as a Second Chance Pill institution, our costs are different from students that are incarcerated and students are in the same program, but they're out basically in society participating as a regular student. And in our case, all of our students are students, but we make sure that in the sense that those costs are applicable to that particular student situation. So yes, students that are in our traditional, say, small business entrepreneur program, and they're here in society, their program or their costs are different than those that are incarcerated.
It just makes common sense to know that when someone reenters with a college degree, they're going to be much better off than somebody that doesn't. There's so many great examples of folks that have gotten out, you know, and been able to enter into society already that they do well. I have a nephew who spent 15 years incarcerated. He was able to pick up an associate degree and a bachelor's degree and changed his life when he came out. He got a job with the post office, and now he's a mid-level manager. He's married. He's got a home. And we have so many examples of folks that come through our program. Once they get a credential, if they're given a fair shot, you know, they'll make good. They'll go out, you know, and they'll do good on their jobs, and they'll do just like anybody else. So it is important, just like it is important for folks who don't really have access to opportunity outside of the prison system to get a Pell Grant, because without the Pell Grant, they may not be able to go on to college and get the credential that they need to have upward mobility. It's certainly important for the criminal justice system to keep and make that opportunity available so that folks are ready to jump into an opportunity.
I think one of the things that about being in prison, right, and working in prisons, there's a community inside prisons, just like the community out here. There are various privileges. I certainly operated with more privilege when I was incarcerated than plenty of the folks I was in prison with. And access to programs, just like out here, access to programs is different for folks inside. There are plenty of people who might not qualify for Pell dollars. And I think that it's really important for universities, for any program that's operating in prisons, to figure out ways to serve the full population of people who are incarcerated. If the outcomes that we talk about wanting to achieve, if those are really the outcomes we're out for, then we've got to figure out how to address the inequities that exist in our system out here and in the system in there. I know that DOE has done a huge amount of work around implementation, trying to put strictures in place to address some of the challenges that we know exist. But what we don't have, and what we didn't have before Pell was eliminated, is long-term evaluation of the efficacy of Pell and how it might address or exacerbate inequity. I think it absolutely critical for this movement, and as the programs are established and move forward, that is happening, and also really important for other entities to be evaluating that work and reporting on it.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. I have to. Okay, so Jonathan's hit on a point that is really interesting and important, and it's this notion that Pell could potentially exacerbate divisions and inequities you see in the prison system. And on first blush, you're thinking, how could that happen? We have a professor, Rosemary Russ, who's teaching a first-year seminar class at Oak Hill now, and she had a portion of her presentation that was going to focus on what she thought were sort of higher ed basics. Mm-hmm. What is an associate's degree? What is a bachelor's degree? And she found that she thought she anticipated spending like 3 minutes on this thing. She spent half the class, like an hour and a half, talking about this because there were so many questions. So our program focuses on, especially on students who are not quite sure they belong in a college classroom and just working to build that initial confidence that they belong there. The level, for a first-generation student, for all the first-generation students in the group, you know that if that's not a part of your upbringing, if that's not a part of your culture growing up, these are things that you just don't know. And that happens in the prison system all the time. And so I think what we have to do, if we really want people to be empowered to make intelligent choices about their education going forward, deciding whether I should go to Madison College or UW-Madison, there are now competing programs in certain prisons, many students are absolutely lost when they are looking at what their options should be. So I think it's on the colleges to get together, to come up with some unified guidance. We're all, no one's in this to make a ton of money off of Pell. Like, that's just not possible. So all the colleges that are really getting into this space are doing it, I think, in Wisconsin for the right reasons. And we need to get together and offer some unified guidance to students before they enroll so they know where they're going.
This is a special broadcast of the 7th Annual Cap Times Idea Fest, which returns September 17th, 2023 to Madison with leaders from government, business, education, social justice, and culture.
So, yeah, there were a number of points here touched on, I think, that were really poignant. And so, for me, a couple of things. I was the first person in the state to actually graduate under the Second Chance Pell pilot program. Huge caveat, I had one class left at that time. So what that is actually a little bit of chip on my shoulder, because I did my entire degree before Pell came in, before people started having Chromebooks inside, before all the support started, right? When the 2018, all that was like right after I finished, right? And so I'm happy for everybody, but it's like all of that could have made my pathway significantly easier. A story that I actually wrote about in the Boston Review, that if you want to check that out as well. It's all kind of plugs and things I wrote. So the another part about it is that Wisconsin, interestingly, was one of the very few states in the entire country to continue funding after Pell was taken away nationally. The Wisconsin Higher Education Grant, as well as a couple of others, people incarcerated were eligible for that. Something I also did not hear about for like 4 years after I started taking classes inside, which is insane, that I'm taking classes for 4 years in prison and no one, staff or anyone, knows that there's money I could be getting from the state the entire time. And that there's a story that still is applicable now in some instances, right? Information is not always readily available in situations where you'd think it would be readily available. But when we talk about this topic of education, one of the things that Jonathan also touched on that's a fear of mine is the exacerbation of the inequality concept. A person that was a very big part of the organization that I run, starting Sean Pika at Hudson Link, which is one of the very few programs, I think, going on back then. I reached out to Sean. I was kind of dogged about just networking with people when I was inside. And I reached out to Sean. Sean answered my calls. I don't know why, but he actually gave us the seed money to start the organization. And one time he was talking about what's known as a selection bias in this work, where the people that are oftentimes in higher education programs are the ones that are most ready for that, and they probably would have made it already in some sense, right? So how do we make sure that this work is actually increasing the people that need it most, the most marginalized in prison? And if I'm being honest, a lot of it's not. It's not going to. A lot of people inside are not going to access higher education. They're not going to take it. It's not going to be interesting to them. For whatever reason inside, they can't follow up with it. It's just different reasons it's not going to happen. So how do we have a wider understanding of higher education that connects with folks beyond just the degree certificate element, but also is helping folks understand you can be a college student. You can go somewhere further. How do we connect you with your potential, even if it's not in this very formal, traditional realm of education? And a lot of that has to do with the way that we, as Peter was talking about, students inside, they just don't know what they can be. They don't see examples of that. I think of the Steve Jobs story about when he started an iPhone. Someone said to Steve Jobs, "What did you do for like research to start the iPhone?" He said, "I didn't ask people that. They didn't even know what an iPhone, they couldn't even conceptualize what that was, and now it's everywhere." And so it's very simple, similar to prison system, where people inside don't have a concept of what they can be, what's possible, what should be available, because it's the same, when you give a starving man a fish, he's gonna think it's the greatest meal ever. But there's actually way better meals. You've just been limited to seeing things. And so how do we start having these pathways to success that are really helping people know what you can be before that opportunity for higher education comes available? Because you're never gonna grab it if you never even see yourself in that. If you never see these examples of success, and the self-empowerment kicks in. And the line I always will say is that a person who knows every language, has every degree, and has every person in the world in his Rolodex, but has no self-confidence, is going to fail 1,000 times. But the person that has none of that, but believes in himself and knows his value, he's gonna find success no matter where you put him at. Mm-hmm. Drop him on an island, he's gonna find his way back to the mainland and own a business in some sense. And so self-empowerment has to be a foundation of higher education, of how we are embedding people with the belief of you can cross that street. Because at the end of the day, nobody in this world is going to help you except yourself. The system should be doing better. We should all be doing better. We should all help each other, our neighbors better. But at the end of the day, you have to be able to cross that street by yourself. And how do we get that ingrained in your understanding is what I think is so key and what I worry about in where we are now with Second Chance Pell and some of the lanes. And so I'm grateful to be a part of some of this work. I hope that we can really avoid what some of these fears are, and we can really ingrain some holistic, powerful ecosystem aspects of self-empowerment along with these degree elements that we're starting to be able to give people more.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I was thinking as you were talking about how you hear this language of second chances so frequently when we talk about this population of folks, right? Second Chance Pell, Second Chances at Success. April is Second Chance Month, right? Is when we celebrate. But in so many cases, we're talking about a first chance. We're talking about a first chance at success. And I think our panelists would agree with me that until we sort of start to have that conversation, as Jonathan, our loving malcontent on this panel, who just keeps telling us, that's not enough, that's not enough, that's not enough. And he's right. It's not enough, right? It's not enough, and it's not early enough. Yes. So we are over time, and unfortunately, you all wrote some incredibly good questions here. So I'm wondering if maybe the IDFS folks can figure out a forum for these questions to be asked and answered. You want me to ask them now? Go ahead, he says. Oh, boy. All right. Well, if you have to leave, no shame. You just get up and leave. Well, let me start with this one, just in case there are folks who are going to have to leave. Where can a person with some hours of time contribute meaningful support within this ecosystem? So I think folks in the room who are hearing this, who want to be involved, who want to stay involved, who want to know more either about your organization or figure out a way to sort of plug into this work, what are opportunities to do that, Shannon?
Ooh, I love this one. Find out what you want to do and what you're good at first. Do not come to us and say, what can I do? What are you good at? Because you have to be plugged into something that matches your strengths, right? Because you're going to get burnt out or bored. The worst thing a volunteer can do for any organization, it's not to not help. It's to tell us you can help. Get trained or onboarded and then disappear. So know what you are good at, please. And we will. I will happily connect you with any organization in this ecosystem that is best for you. It's not about organization. It's about where you fit in best. Because whatever you're good at, there's somebody that needs that specific skill set in this space doing something.
And how do people connect to the community if they want to know more about your...
We have a complex website, so I'm happy to give my card out to anyone. I could say it, but it's not going to be remembered. So I'm happy to meet with anyone afterwards and hand my card out for that. Yeah.
Other thoughts?
Sure. With our fatherhood program, they can contact Eugene Chrysler. We have actually a need for mentors. And so if there are folks out there who have had good experience and they want to reach back, you know, and help someone else find their way, they can reach us at ulgm.org and look for our fatherhood program, and we can help you be a part of volunteering and helping somebody else.
That was ulgm.org. Urban League of Greater Madison.org.
I think on the Madison College platform, we have Dean Rasmussen that's here that leads our early college and workforce development area. She will be a great connect to be able to partnership with Madison College in the work that we're doing.
I will plug one thing that I think Jonathan should plug, which is that there's an organization on which he is a member of the board, at which he is a member of the board, called the Alliance for Higher Education in Prison. If you want to know more sort of from a national perspective about what does this movement look like, how many programs are out there, which schools are participating, sort of how are folks that have been in this work trying to get higher ed in prison started at their schools, and good partnerships going with reentry organizations and places like the Urban League. What is that looking like from a sort of national perspective? I would encourage you to check out the Alliance for, and I think it's Alliance, oh God. Higheredinprison.org. Thank you so much. Jonathan's on the board.
I'm not going to talk about the Alliance, but once you go to the Alliance website and learn about it and all that wonderful stuff, the thing that I think is really important for folks to do is talk about this work within their communities, to call their legislator and tell them that this is a thing that really matters to them. I think that it's really easy for this work to happen in, I mean, this is a wonderful room and a wonderful building, and this is a conversation that I think everybody in Madison probably would have some interest in, right? And hopefully when this is recorded and distributed, everybody will hear it and talk about it. That'd be great. But this stuff changes when the legislature starts directing money towards it and starts thinking about it differently and understands that it's not just about college, it's about the overall cost of operating a system or the long-term costs of reentry or supervision in Wisconsin, things like that. Talk about it. That's what you should do. Yeah.
Keep rolling here. So you said something that kind of reminded me. So advocacy is not just going to politicians. It's always your neighbors. It's also your coworkers. It's your family members. We do a lot, I think, in life in general of kicking people when they don't agree with us, of shaming people when they don't agree with us, of yelling at people when they don't agree with us. And that makes them more likely to disagree with us, right? So how do we just challenge folks to see things differently, to look at the way they're viewing the world in conversational ways, right? So just dialogue, conversation about this issue, about seeing people that have criminal records in a different way. That's a powerful thing, because then that slowly leads to that change in political realms as well.
That's a great segue, actually, into a couple of the questions I'll sort of mush together here, because we got a handful of questions about things related to changing cultural narratives, particularly a question here about buy-in from the Department of Corrections. What does that look like? How does that work? How are they training correctional officers? But I think the question here really is, how do we leave this room and tell the story of this work in a way that sounds appropriate and like it makes sense? And I used to say all the time in Tennessee, at least, that an investment in higher ed in prison was an investment, you know, in the belief that all communities in the state of Tennessee deserved an opportunity to thrive, all of them. And it's a public safety issue and it's a public health issue as far as I'm concerned. I'm the victim of a violent crime. And if you want to think about there being fewer victims of violent crimes, college and prison, that's going to help, right? It's public safety. It's public health. So some questions here just sort of about changing the narrative. How do we change the larger narrative of a society that sees incarcerated persons as undeserving of social benefits like a college education? Questions about buy-in from the Department of Corrections. Yes. So from the panel, thoughts about that?
As my hat says, I do a lot about correcting the narrative in my work. And so, as I just said about conversing with, you know, your neighbors and your coworkers and your family is one big one. We do these events where we try to go around. We have one in Green Bay on the 27th, actually, where our Correcting the Narrative event is highlighting these vignettes of successful examples of people that have criminal records that we've taken. As I do this work across the country, I'm always meeting more and more successful examples of people that have criminal records. We're often hidden, like Jonathan was for the whole time I knew him, until today, finding out that he had a record, right? So what happens is that's just the way it operates, is that we don't talk about it because of the stigma. Sometimes very good reasons we don't talk about it, because you can get fired, you can get canceled, whatever might happen. So you have to be respectful of that when folks don't want to talk about that story. But people not talking about that story just breeds more fear about our population, because they don't realize amongst them in society every day are people that have a criminal record. And you would never have a fear of them until they told you, I have a criminal record. And suddenly, like, something flicks in your mind. And it's like, oh, beware. You know me for 10 years. Why are you suddenly scared of me? So that's just the way the mind is, knowing why the mind is. And these type of events where we like to have... This is a crowd that is great, but this is not the kind of crowd that needs to hear this the most. Right? The kind of crowd that needs to hear this the most are more in, like, business and science and areas that are not... reading the Cap Times all the time, right? So, like, how do we access more communities as well to get them to see that there's more here? You have to see this. I kind of like think of it as, like, not allowing you to get away from this picture. Like, no matter where you turn, we're going to be there, right? I don't have to yell at you, kick you. I don't have to shame you. But I need you to see this. I need you to see who I am for yourself. It's not about seeing me because I want something different. It's because your own community, your own family, yourself are actually lessened and less safe because you're not seeing this issue in our population fully. And so it's for everyone. And, you know, that aspect of going to different communities to proactively correct the narrative about our population is a big part of what we do. And I just always encourage people, you know, be an evangelist. Just ask people, do you know about this issue? Do you really know about this population? And folks don't. So this little bitty conversations can kick flames of, a revolution.
This has been a special Civic Media broadcast of a small portion of the 7th Annual Cap Times Idea Fest, recorded on September 17th, 2023, in Madison, with leaders from government, business, education, social justice, and culture. To learn and hear more, please visit captimesideafest.com/sessions.
Like smelt fries and music on the river, we're uniquely Amory. This is Lake Air 1260 AM WLAK, Amory's radio station. You're listening to Lake Air, WLAK 1260 AM Amory, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.